Please call the roll.
Senator Kelly?
Here.
Senator Tocco?
Here.
Senator Josephson?
Here.
Senator Faye?
Here.
Senator Bennett?
Let the record show that there is a quorum of the Rules Committee present. Today is Tuesday, July 30th, 1985, in the Senate Finance Room, Juneau, Alaska, at 1:30 p.m. We're going to hear today from Assistant Attorney General John Rubini. Mr. Rubini, would you take the stand, please? Mr. Rubini, pursuant to Alaska Statute 2425060, the President of the Senate, Speaker of the House of Representatives, and the Chairman of every committee of either body may administer an oath to a witness appearing before their respective bodies. A person who willfully swears or affirms falsely concerning any matter material to the conviction is punishable by imprisonment for not less than 1 year, no more than 5 years. Would you raise your right hand, please? Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give in this matter will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Sit down, please. The order of questioning will be the Senate Counsel, the Governor's Counsel, and the Senators. Mr. Dash?
Would you?
Senator Sackett?
We've just been passed out a letter from Mr. Brown, Mr. Hickey, and Mr. Gonelli regarding changes that have been made, or evidently a final proof version of the recorded statement. Having gone through the original statement that was provided to us, how significantly different is this, and will we have time to analyze both?
Mr. Chairman, we have also just received this and are going over it, and I cannot at this point compare the final approved version with the draft, but to the extent possible, we can have that being done by staff during the process of this hearing.
We'll look into that, Senator, and get it back to you. Senator
Halford?
There is one area that I noticed in the differences and went back to check where the governor responded to a question about the final four maps versus the final core maps. And there is a significant difference there in what the governor's knowledge of the maps was.
Did you have access to this?
No, I didn't have access to this. I asked to find out if the four map statement was accurate, and they weren't sure. I'm not sure how it's reflected in here.
We'll research that issue and try to get back to you, Senator. Mr. Dash.
Would you state for the record your full name?
Yes, Jonathan Rubini.
Rubini, you're appearing before this committee on the subpoena. Is that true?
That's correct.
What is your position?
I'm an assistant attorney general.
How long have you held that position?
Approximately 3 years.
Now, focusing your attention on late March and early April this year, 1985, did you have a conversation with Mr. Stock and Mr. Link of the Department of Administration about a information request on the Fairbanks lease situation from Stan Jones of the Daily News Miner of Fairbanks?
Yes, I did.
When was that?
That would have been on Friday morning, March 29th. At the conclusion of a meeting that Mr. Stock and Mr. Link had requested to address legal questions related to the Anchorage office complex litigation.
Now, did you ascertain the precise nature of this request?
As Mr. Stock and Mr. Link initially presented their inquiry, again, it was at the tail end of a meeting dealing with unrelated legal matters. As an afterthought, Mr. Stack wanted to get my legal insight into how to respond to an oral request that one of their staff had received regarding the Fairbanks lease file.
Who was that staff member that received it?
I believe the initial phone call was to Mr. Peterson, and he in turn referred it to Mr. Link and to Mr. Stack.
Were you informed by Mr. Stack or Mr. Link what it was that Mr. Jones was looking for?
As they initially presented their request for assistance to me, they were trying to decide how to respond to Mr. Jones's request. Again, it was an oral request, and that's a difference under our law and regulations, and they wanted to respond simply in an informal manner. And in the course of trying to decide how to respond in an informal manner, They let me know that there were embarrassing material in the file. They did not believe it related to what Mr. Jones was interested in, and at that time, I started to ask questions as to how they knew what Mr. Jones was looking for.
Did you ask them for the file itself?
Not at that time.
Did you at some time obtain the Department of Administration file?
Yes, I did, later that day.
And from whom did you obtain it?
Mr. Stack, I believe.
Now, when you say later that day, you mean on March 29?
That's correct.
Now, did you review the file, or was it reviewed?
I initially reviewed it myself, and then I reviewed it with Mr. Lawrenson and Mr. Hickey.
Could you just briefly describe for the committee the nature of this file?
I describe it as probably 3 to 5 inches thick. It was organized with a great deal of regular boilerplate information that you see in a regular lease file. Extensive personal notes that appear to be Mr. Jackson's phone logs, and internal memoranda dealing with the procurement as it developed.
Did you come to a conclusion after looking at some of the contents of the file as to whether or not Mr. Stock's characterization that it would had embarrassing material in it or something that revealed irregularities? I mean, did you come to any conclusion as to what the file revealed?
Yes, I did.
And could you tell the committee what that was?
Documents within in the file, both internal memoranda and more specifically some of the notes, either Mr. Jackson's phone logs or side notes, such as on the back of phone messages, things of that nature, indicated embarrassing material in the file.
Did you become concerned about the contents of that file? The question is not directed at personal concern, but did you become concerned as a member of the Attorney General's office over the contents of that file?
At the least, I was concerned that the file contained information which would have been embarrassing to the administration.
What, if any, action did you take, Mr. Rabini? Immediately, the initial action.
The initial action was reviewing the file with Mr. Lawrenson and Mr. Hickey.
Who is Mr. Lawrenson?
Mr. Lawrenson is the Deputy Attorney General.
And who is Mr. Hickey?
Mr. Hickey is the Chief Prosecutor for the state.
When was that? When did that review take place?
It took place in the early afternoon of Friday, the March 29th.
Now, after that review, was any decision made by you or Mr. Lawrenson or the both of you?
Our initial decision, again, our immediate focus was how to respond to the press request for information. And our initial decision was that the entire file was disclosable to the press. Again, as background to that, Mr. Stack had indicated when he first came to me that Mr. Jones, in his judgment, was interested in material that related to whether or not the building satisfied the aesthetic needs of the state. There was some concern, I think the initial press article dealt with some concern from some state agencies as to whether they would be happy within the Fifth Avenue Center. As I discussed it with Mr. Stack, it became apparent that Mr. Peterson had recorded, as his Department of Administration practice apparently, a phone log of his conversation with Mr. Jones. When Mr. Stack, again, before I had the file, Mr. Stack called me and read me Mr. Peterson's phone log, and it was apparent on the phone log that Mr. Jones, as well as the aesthetic considerations, was interested in procurement irregularities.
Now, did you or Mr. Lawrenson think to report what you were observing or reviewing to the Attorney General?
The Attorney General was not in town that day.
So you weren't able to report to the Attorney General?
No, we weren't.
Did you consider that the matter was of some essence and time? Was there time pressure to make a decision as to what to do?
Not in that immediate sense of needing to get in touch with the Attorney General while he was out of the city for
that
day.
Well, you said, I think, that you had to make a decision whether to release the file. You thought it was it should be disclosed, or could be disclosed legally.
Again, Mr. Dash, as an oral request, our initial decision was that it would be releasable, but since it was an oral request and we had already observed that Department of Administration had not referred it to our attention for some, I think it was 10 or 12 days after the initial phone call was made, and under our regulations, that request is already deemed denied. So our initial decision was to wait and see if Mr. Jones was still interested in the file.
Well, did you consider whether or not, because I think you've indicated that there was embarrassing information in the file, that this information should be reported to the governor?
Yes, we did.
And did you attempt to do that?
Yes, later in the afternoon, again, still on Friday, I called Lori Herman, let her know that I had a file which we believe she ought to see, and we, 10 or 15 minutes after that phone call, went down to her office.
Why, instead of calling Ms. Herman, why didn't you try to get to see the governor?
Calling Ms. Herman was my ordinary course of business.
Could you explain that?
I deal relatively regularly with the governor's office, and my more immediate contacts are with either Ms. Herman or with the chief of staff.
And was it your view that talking to Ms. Herman was in fact getting the ear of the governor?
That was my assumption.
Okay, then was there a meeting with Ms. Herman?
Yes, Ron Lawrence and myself went downstairs to her office late in the afternoon on Friday.
And who attended that meeting, Mr. Verbini?
Ron Lawrence and myself, Lori Herman.
Did you take the file along with you?
Yes, we did.
Did you discuss the file with Ms. Herman?
Yes, I think I, when we went into her office, I in all likelihood, but I can't specifically recall, gave her a 1 or 2 minute description of the procurement from my knowledge of it, and then showed her the file. And at that time, we had paper clipped those portions of the file that we thought would be of particular concern to her. And
now, when you say that you gave her a brief review of what you knew about the matter, did this refer to the file itself or to any other information you may have had from the Department of Administration?
Don't have any specific recollection as to those opening statements. I was familiar with earlier aspects of the procurement, and in all likelihood I would have described them briefly.
Well, can you just briefly tell the committee what that earlier relationship involved?
In early October, and it's now apparent in October 2nd, Mr. Stack and later Mr. Link and at times Mr. Moore came to my office initially and expressed concerns as to what they perceived as undue pressure in restricting the zone of procurement. We ultimately, after a series of meetings, I met with Jim Baldwin and those same gentlemen, and after that meeting, Mr. Baldwin and myself advised the Attorney General of a problem in the procurement.
Were you informed by Mr. Stock at that time with regard to these pressures dealing with the changing of the boundaries, I think? Who was bringing those pressures?
We understood in context that Mr. Stock was dealing with Mr. Shively.
Now, at the time that you reviewed this file and talked to Mrs. Herman, did you indicate to her that any focus of the file or this information was on Mr. Shively?
Yes, we did. The documents that we had clipped for her attention, some of them indicated either most of the references to Mr. Shively were handwritten notes, either in Mr. Jackson's phone logs or in messages indicating either concerns by Mr. Jackson or Mr. Peterson, and at times it referred to Mr. Shively.
Did you later copy any of the documents from the file and give them to Ms. Herman?
Yes, I did.
Did you keep any of those copies, either for yourself or Mr. Lawrence?
Yes, as I recall, I think I ran 3 or 4 copies of the documents that I copied. I brought one back downstairs to Lori's office later again on Friday, left one in the Attorney General's office, one with the Deputy Attorney General, and one with myself, as well as the original file.
Mr. Bini, I'm going to have you look at copies of pages that I received from you and ask you if you can identify whether or not these are the pages that you took out of the file, made copies for Ms. Herman, and kept for yourself. Could you also distribute them to the members of the committee in the Senate and also to Mr. LaCavera?
Yes, of course we'll. This will be S3. Mr. Chairman, I'd like this copies from the file be marked S3, and if it could be read into the record.
Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent that the memos handed to us marked S3 be submitted to the record, and ask unanimous consent.
No objection, so ordered.
Mr. Ravini, where were these? This file, have you looked at it? Have you received it?
Yes, I glanced through them.
Where was this found?
When Mr. Hamilton initially interviewed me several days ago, he asked whether or not I had a copy of this file. I did not. We just had made a phone call to Ron Lawrenson, who was then in Anchorage. It turns out Mr. Lawrenson had a copy of this file on his desk.
By the way, when was that file found?
I believe it was Wednesday or Thursday of last week.
I believe the record showed that it was July 26, and you turned it over to us at our request?
Yes, we did.
Now, looking at the file, and I address your attention to a memorandum from Barry Jackson to Robert Link, dated January 3rd, somewhat in the middle of the file, and ask you whether or not the file deals with changes of geographic boundaries in the RFP.
Yes, it does.
Yes. I'm sorry. There's the first item, Mr. Chairman, are handwritten notes. By the way, the handwritten notes are been typed on the back, the first part. You don't have to, not all of them, just the ones that that were represented to us as to be Mr. Peterson's notes.
So the legal, excuse me.
The legal line, the legal page with type is a typed transcription of or translation of the handwritten notes. And then the, right, after the handwritten notes, there is a memorandum, January 15, 1985, from Barry Jackson to Robert Link. Following that is a memorandum from Robert Link to Barry Jackson, dated January 8, 1985. And following that is a memo to record, for record, from Richard Peterson, dated December 19, 1985. And the document I'm now directing Mr. Rubini's attention to is the memorandum from Barry Jackson to Robert Link, dated January 3, 1985.
Are all the handwritten notes translated on the legal sheets?
No, the only ones that we translated on the legal sheet are the series of notes that come prior to another document, which I haven't mentioned. It's a title on top, Press Contact, Subject File, dated March 15, 1985, from Dick Peterson. You see that? These are the notes that appear right in front of that.
Okay.
They're the only ones that have been typed.
So let me ask one more time, Mr. Chairman, because I'm still a little confused. These three, four pages of notes right here?
Yes, should be.
Have been all translated?
Should
have
been all translated.
Okay, thank you. I'm set.
Senator Victor Fisher.
I must have missed it. Whose notes are these handwritten notes?
It was represented to us to be Mr. Peterson's notes.
Thank you.
Mr. Rubini, getting back to the memorandum of January 3 from Barry Jackson to Robert Link, could you identify where in the memorandum there's any reference to the geographic boundaries, and in what context does that is that reference made?
Mr. Desch, the reference to the limitation on the geographic boundaries is stated in item A under the alphabetical list of items.
Now, is it true that that list of items follows a statement that reads as follows in the second paragraph? Prior to his verbal directive, we had been following a carefully considered negotiating strategy aimed at making the best of an already poor negotiating position. Let me set the scene, colon. Now, those items now are the items that Mr. Jackson is preparing or presenting to Mr. Link, according to this memorandum, and setting the scene of what he says is a poor negotiating position. Is that your understanding?
That's correct.
All right. The first one states that, A, geographic boundaries have been set which eliminate all but one possible source of office space. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then, is B, states a bid waiver has been granted to permit sole source negotiating on the basis that the specified boundaries would not allow competition.
That's correct.
And C, an occupancy date has been selected which would prevent any possible new construction from competing with a sole source. That's it.
That's right.
I just draw your attention to those items. Now, is there any reference in the file to interference with the Department of Administration in this transaction beginning on October 2, 1984? And I direct your attention to Mr. Peterson's memorandum of December 19, 1984. Would you turn to the last page of that memorandum, which is page 2? And the last sentence, could you read that for us?
Perhaps the interference that started on October 2nd, 1984 will relent and we can still reach an agreement based on professional knowledge beneficial to the state rather than a selected group.
And would you state again what information you had at the time you had this file and read it as to what your understanding was in terms of interference, as to from where that interference came?
Again, Mr. Dash, at the time I was reviewing this file, I did not know specifically when Mr. Stock, Mr. Link, and Mr. Moore had come to me earlier in the fall to state their concerns about pressure relating to the zone of procurement. I understood it was in that time period, though. At that time, Mr. Stack had privately passed on his reference that he had heard, or Commissioner Rudd had told him that this was something to the effect of a political payoff. So I was aware of that statement as well.
But were you aware from your earlier information from the Mr. Stock as to who he had indicated was bringing the pressure that supposedly started sometime in October 2?
No specific recollection, but from context, I understood that his dealings were with Mr. Shively.
And did you, in your discussions with Ms. Herman, in the context and the material that you were giving her in the file and the information that you were said that you gave her from the background of this, refer to Mr. Shively?
Yes, we did.
As a matter of fact, was there any discussion as to who should be given the information that you were now relaying to Ms. Herman?
Yes, there was. At the very end of our meeting, and if I was to estimate, it lasted maybe a half an hour. I believe Lori Herman asked whether she could show it to the governor and to John Shively.
And how did you respond to that?
I don't recall the response as to the governor, though. My understanding and the very reason for bringing the file to Lori Herman's attention was for the governor to be informed of its existence and content. Ron Lawrenson and Lori Herman had a very brief discussion as to whether or not the file should be shown to Mr. Shively.
Did you hear that discussion?
I did, and I don't have a very clear recollection as to what the substance of that conversation was.
Well, Mr. Lawrenson is here, and we could ask him.
That's correct.
Now, when you left, did you leave, Ms. Herman, the copies of the pages that you had copied out of the file?
Not at that time. There was brief discussion as to whether she should keep the file to show it to whoever, and we elected to take the file with us, and I provided copies of those portions that we had identified in our review of the file. And later that afternoon, I brought those copies back to her.
You brought it to her.
That's
now, I think you started to tell us that you do recall some discussion of political pressure coming up. And could you just tell us something about whether or not any names were mentioned at that time?
Yes, during our discussions with Lori Herman, Ron Lawrenson raised some question, and I don't recall how he specifically started off on this line of questions, but some give and take as to who the owners of the building were. And the only name that we were aware of up until that time was Jeff Cook. And through our review of the file, it seemed apparent that his interest was that as a realtor, and it didn't make any sense in context with the statement of political payoff. And so Mr. Lawrenson raised some questions, and at that time, Lori indicated that Lenny Arsenault held an ownership interest in the building.
Now, after that time, did you have any later discussions with Ms. Herman concerning your visit and the file and the subject matter you discussed with her?
Yes, I did.
Could you tell us about that?
During the following week, I was in Anchorage attending other matters, and on a daily basis, I was in touch with Lori Herman. And during one of those phone calls, and again, I'm not sure what day, I think it was either Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, she indicated that she had discussed the matter with the governor.
I have no further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fakes?
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm just a little confused as to how many meetings there were with Ms. Herman. Is it just the March 29th meeting that we're talking about, that you went in the morning with Mr. Lawrenson and then came back? You took the file with you, made copies, and then took them back? Or was there more than one meeting that day with Lori Herman? I'm confused at the number of Lori Herman meetings.
One meeting that took place late in the afternoon of Friday the 29th, when I brought the material back, I'm sure I handed it to Lori, but I don't recall any discussion about it.
So this was all on this one meeting?
That's correct.
And then the next week, you had daily phone calls with her, and then sometime during that week, she told you she had told the governor?
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Victor Fisher, did you want to be recognized?
No, I'm
sorry.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Mr. Lacavara, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Rubini.
Good afternoon.
Let's go through some of the facts that will fill in the rest of the story, if we may. You are the Assistant Attorney General with principal responsibility for liaison with the Department of Administration and its procurement functions. Is that correct?
I'm one of the Assistant Attorney Generals who deals with the Department of Administration on those functions.
How would you characterize your responsibility for procurement issues arising in the Department of Administration?
There is a group of four attorneys within the Department of Law who deal with the Department of Administration. Of those four, Jim Baldwin and myself probably deal with them on a general basis more regularly than the others.
Thank you. Counsel started out discussing the Stan Jones request in April or late March 1985. Then we got to the discussions in October, but let's reverse that sequence and take them up chronologically. Is that all right?
That's fine.
Thank you. You first became aware of this situation, the Fairbanks office lease situation, on October 2nd. Is that correct?
That's correct.
When Anselm Stock came to you?
Yes.
He is somebody with whom you had had regular dealings in your position as Assistant Attorney General. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you mentioned that he raised some concerns with you. You referred a moment ago to the reference to a political payoff comment that allegedly Commissioner Rudd made in his presence. Was that your primary understanding of what was bothering Mr. Stack on October 2nd?
No, it wasn't. That was offered. I'd characterize it in the form of executive gossip. And it apparent from the context that it had taken place earlier, and he was just offering that statement to me. It was of concern to me when I heard it. His concern in coming to my office had to do with the zone of procurement and a recommendation that they had been presented to them to provide for a very limited or restricted zone of procurement.
And your concern, as I understand it, is that that zone was arbitrary within the meaning of the standard applied by the courts on judicial review of procurement matters. Is that correct?
That's correct, based on their professional judgment that that zone did not have a solid basis.
Now, did you know that within a day or so, that zone that he thought might be arbitrary had been changed by Mr. Shively?
That was the precise reason he came to my office, was to solicit our help in getting that zone enlarged.
Yes, we're going to go through that. And in fact, at the outcome of this process, within a day or two, the assistance of the Department of Law led to Mr. Shively's approval of a zone that was considered not arbitrary. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. You and Mr. Baldwin discussed this problem with Mr. Stack. Is that true?
Ultimately.
In October 2nd or so?
Either would have been, I believe it was October 2nd still. It could
yes.
have been October 3rd.
And you reported to the Attorney General, Mr. Gorsuch, at that time that problems have been raised by Mr. Stock concerning the Fairbanks procurement.
That's correct.
You suggested to the Attorney General that he bring these problems to the attention of the governor's office?
I don't know if I suggested it, but that was the consensus of that meeting.
It was suggested to the Attorney General that he should bring these problems to the attention of the governor's office. Is that correct?
That was a consensus. Whether or not he initiated that suggestion or whether we suggested it, I don't recall.
Right. Did the Attorney General ever tell you what, if anything, he did as a result of that consensus?
Yes, he reported back to both Jim Baldwin and myself that he had discussed the matter and that, again, there were two issues pending, two concerns that we addressed to the Attorney General. One was the statement of the political payoff. The second was the limitation on the zone of procurement. He reported back that it was a perception problem on the part of the Department of Administration, which I assumed to be with reference to the political payoff language. And I learned either from the Attorney General or from the Department of Administration that the zone of procurement had in fact been expanded to that which we recommended.
When you say, Mr. Rubini, that it was the consensus that the Attorney General should raise these questions with the governor's office, what was your understanding who the governor's office was at that time? Governor Sheffield personally?
It could have been Governor Sheffield. It could have been Lori Herman.
What was your expectation?
My expectation, given normal office procedures, would have been Lori Herman.
Did Mr. Gorsuch indicate to whom he actually spoke on this subject?
He could have, though I don't recall.
He didn't say he spoke to Governor Sheffield.
I don't recall.
You were asked similar questions when you were interviewed by the trooper and by Dean Guinelli of the Attorney General's office on April 9, 1985. Do you recall being asked that question?
Yes, I do.
May I refer you to, do you have available to you your statement? I'd like to refer you to page 9, see whether this accurately and fully recounts your recollection of this conversation back in October, in which the Attorney General reported back to you. This is the bottom of page 9, Rubini. Well, as I stated, Jim and I, is that Jim Baldwin?
Yes, it is.
Went and talked to Norm, that would be Norm Gorsuch, the Attorney General.
That's correct.
About this problem of what we perceive to be, or what we perceive to be a problem. And Norm talked with the governor's office, and I don't know specifically who he spoke with, and he reported back to Jim and I that, in fact, it appeared to be more of a perception problem from the people in the Department of Administration side that, you know, their perception was that it was a political procurement was not accurate from the governor's office perspective, and that they were overreacting to whatever signals were being sent. And apparently the message was conveyed because, you know, our immediate understanding was that the decision was made not to go to the very restricted recruitment area, and that was an important decision from the people in the Department of Administration's perspective, end quote. Is that an accurate rendition of what you informed the investigators?
Accurate, though not very articulate.
None of us likes to see his words in a transcript. As a brother lawyer, I can share that with you. I thought it was quite articulate, Mr. Rubini. So the Attorney General told you that talking to somebody in the Attorney General's office, but as far as we know, not the governor, this was an overreaction by the Department of Administration and not a legitimate concern. That is, not a concern that was grounded in fact. That's what the Attorney General told you.
That's correct.
Did you have any basis to doubt his assessment?
Absolutely not.
Would it be fair to say, Mr. Rubini, that his report back struck you and Mr. Baldwin as quite plausible because it coincided with your own assessment, that these concerns raised by Mr. Stock were likely to be exaggerated or unfounded?
That's accurate, and based on a prior experience involving similar concerns.
Well, I'd like to go through that a little bit with you to see whether your understanding at the time was the same as your colleague, Mr. Baldwin, who I gather from your testimony a few minutes ago also had regular contact with the Department of Administration in general and in particular with Anselm Stock. I'd like to refer you and the members of the committee to Mr. Baldwin's grand jury transcript on page 482, and I will read a brief excerpt, Mr. Rubini, to see whether you agree or disagree that your perception at the time was the same as that of Assistant Attorney General Baldwin. This is at line 23 of Mr. Baldwin's testimony, where he's describing that you and Mr. Baldwin, when you were first approached by Mr. Stock, asked him to go back and consider what he was saying before you decided to take this any further. Question: what was your purpose in having him do that? Answer: well, I think that, to be candid, Mr. Stock is an individual that has a conspiratorial view of government, and I wanted to be sure that he was absolutely serious about this, because I consider it to be a very serious allegation that he made, and I didn't want it to be done in jest or out of any other motive other than to see that the right thing was done. So I wanted him to go home and think about it and come back and we'd deal with it the next day. Question: when you say that Mr. Stock has a conspiratorial view of government, that's an opinion you hold? Answer: that's an opinion that I hold. Question: and it's based on what? Answer: based on knowing Mr. Stock for about 4 or 5 years. Close quote. Do you recall those statements?
Yes, I do.
This is Mr. Baldwin's view, but do you share that view?
I don't believe I would use the word conspiratorial, but I share the general substance of his observation.
Let's continue on, if we may, to see whether we can see whether you agree with Mr. Baldwin's explanation of what he meant by saying this was conspiratorial. Line 24 on the same page. What do you mean by conspiratorial view of government or state government? Turning the page. Answer: well, it's hard to define. I think he overreacts to things. He has an idea that something is going on behind every bookcase, I think, is kind of his approach to things. He comes to our office a lot, and we have a close relationship with him, and I have a lot of confidence in indistinguishable. We joke around a lot about things that happen in government, and I wanted to make sure that this wasn't a joke. So that's why I say conspiratorial view. He tends to be overly suspicious of people's motives and their intent. Close quote. With that interpretation or explanation of what Mr. Baldwin characterized as Mr. Stock's conspiratorial presumption, would you say you agreed or disagreed with that assessment?
I agree with the general substance. Mr. Stock, in my opinion, tends to exaggerate certain matters.
Thank you. And after the Attorney General told you that the perception problem, and he said it was simply a perception problem, was solved, that reassured you, and you found that to be quite a plausible conclusion, because, as you pointed out, I believe on pages 9 and 10 of your statements to the troopers, that the decision was made not to go to the very restricted recruitment area, close quote.
That's correct.
So the problem that had led Mr. Stock to come to you had immediately been resolved within a day or so of the conversation that you had.
Correct.
Are you aware of any further meetings that Mr. Baldwin, your colleague, may have had with John Shively on this specific problem of whether or not this was a politically motivated procurement or a legitimate one?
I'm not aware of any meetings that dealt with whether or not it was a politically motivated procurement.
Are you aware of any meetings that John Shively and Mr. Baldwin had concerning the approach to be used in this procurement of the Fairbanks office complex?
I'm generally familiar that meetings took place. Nothing beyond that level of familiarity.
Well, let me see if I can refresh your recollection of some comment that Mr. Baldwin may have made to you, or perhaps Mr. Stock or Mr. Shively. For the committee's benefit, I'm referring to the statement given by James L. Baldwin on April 8, 1985, before Randy Johnston, the investigator, and Assistant Attorney General Guinelli. He's asked to explain a meeting that he had with John Shively, he being Assistant Attorney General Baldwin, and specifically whether he had an impression as to what Mr. Shively wanted, whether he wanted this contract to be competitively bid or to go sole source. And Mr. Baldwin stated to the investigators, "Well, I had an impression through our meetings. I think at the first one I got the impression. At that time I don't know whether if they had decided how they, I think they did." Not quite as articulate as you, Mr. Rubini. "It was discussed about going out for competition because that's what GS&S was concerned about. They didn't want to go out for competition if there was only one bidder. They felt that that would be bid rigging," and I interject, we'll come back to bid rigging in a moment, "and their words, and the state wouldn't get a good deal. So I believe I did discuss it with them, and my impression at that time was that Shively, because he doesn't understand government contracting all that well, believed that it would be more open and above board to go out with a competitive procurement than to go sole source." He continues on, and I'll skip a reference to a specific contract where there was some dispute about whether it should have been sole source as the Department of Law recommended. "So he believed that if you went out with competitive advertising and all that sort of thing, you were being open and above board," and I'll skip down toward the end on page 9. "So it was my impression that the reason he," that's Shively, "was doing it was to be open and above board and not to do anything underneath the table. And I told him that there were other ways of doing it and still be open and above board and do a sole source procurement if that's all we had in the area was one vendor. We should only deal with one vendor." End of the material I'll quote from. Did Mr. Baldwin ever convey to you the substance of that discussion with Mr. Shively?
Again, I was generally familiar with those concerns and those discussions, but don't have any specific recollection of him relaying that particular meeting.
All right, but you did learn shortly thereafter, around that time, that sole source negotiation, as recommended by Mr. Baldwin, was the method that was approved for this contract.
That's correct.
There's just one other conversation that I would wonder whether you and Mr. Baldwin discussed. It's another conversation between Mr. Baldwin and Mr. Shively. It's in Mr. Baldwin's grand jury testimony at page 489. Mr. Baldwin was there asked what it was he was trying to get Mr. Shively to do. Reading from line 1, question, and I'll read as far as line 16. "What did you feel you needed to try and get him to do?" Answer, "Well, I wasn't clear at that time. I was hoping that I could get him to give me some general charge to try to get in there and work with the agency and rectify the situation." Question, "And did he do that?" Answer, "Well, I believe he did. I believe he said, go back and check it out. And it's not our intent to in any way force anyone to do anything or to violate the law. And you should check it out and report back to me. That's usually what his charge is to me when I bring things to his attention. Go check it out and come back to me and let me know what the situation is, what your recommendation is. I believe he gave me that charge," close quote. Are you familiar with that meeting that Mr. Baldwin had with Mr. Shively?
No, I'm not.
But are you familiar with the outcome of that meeting?
Generally.
Thank you. Let's turn to the bid rigging memorandum. This is Exhibit 14 for the benefit of the members of the committee. It's on page 13. It is, I believe, one of the embarrassing memos, so-called, that you found in the file. Do you have a copy of that available to you? This is a memorandum from Mr. Peterson to Mr. Link, dated October 5, 1985.
I have a copy of the grand jury exhibit, and turning to my page 13, it's...
Yes, exhibit 14, I'm sorry, on page 37.
Thank you.
You'll see in the second to last line, Mr. Peterson, in a letter to Bob, a memorandum to Bob Link, states that bidding would serve no purpose and would have the appearance of bid rigging. Do you see that
yes,
section?
Yes, I do.
Have you heard the term bid rigging in connection with this procurement before?
I'm familiar with this memoranda. If apart from this memoranda, it could have been raised when Mr. Stack, Mr. Moore, and Mr. Link came to my office and Jim Baldwin's office in October.
Would it be fair to say, Mr. Rubini, that the charge of bid rigging was one of the embarrassing elements that was contained in the file?
As I read that, I wouldn't characterize that as embarrassing. It seems to me, from a legal perspective, inappropriate.
Oh, good. Well, let's turn to that. We have here, Mr. Peterson, as far as you know, is not a lawyer, is he?
No, he's not.
No. He doesn't have any idea what bid rigging is, apparently, does he?
He may or may not, but it doesn't appear so by this memorandum.
Well, let's see if you would agree with the advice that Mr. Baldwin apparently gave when another one of the people who made the embarrassing files came to Mr. Baldwin to level the bid rigging charge. And I would refer you to Mr. Rubini to page 491 of the grand jury transcript. Mr. Baldwin was asked to relate a conversation that he had with Bruce Moore, who was another operating level official in the Department of Administration.
That's correct.
You know who Bruce Moore is?
Yes, I did.
And on the prior page, beginning at line 22, you and the committee will see, Mr. Baldwin testified, well, his purpose was to come. The meeting began with his complaining about the whole procurement process and wanting an opinion from me as to whether it would have been appropriate for them to bid a contract by sealed bid. He termed that bid rigging and wanted to know if I would agree with that characterization. Mr. Baldwin responded to that characterization, which has been much mooted about in connection with this matter. Beginning at line 6 on page 491, question, and did you have an opinion on that characterization? Answer, well, I didn't, yes, I'm sorry, I'm not waiting. Yes, I didn't take seriously his comment that it was bid rigging because I don't view bid rigging as being that sort of activity. In my mind, bid rigging is when a bunch of bidders get together and fix their prices and then agree to bid a certain way on a contract. This was a situation where we were apparently going into a zone where there was no competition, and that's not typically bid rigging, and I believe I explained that to him. Close quote. Would that also be your assessment of whether the bid rigging characterization had any legal substance to it?
That'd be my characterization as well.
Thank you. All right, let's jump ahead a few months to March 29th. Stan Jones has made his request to the Anchorage office to Mr. Peterson, and 10 days later or so, Mr. Stock brings the problem and puts it in your lap. You testified a few moments ago, I think, that you promptly told the Deputy Attorney General, Ron Lawrenson, and the Chief Prosecutor, Mr. Hickey, on that date, March 29, that Mr. Stock had said that Commissioner Rudd had earlier termed the procurement a political payoff to Jeff Cook. Is that correct?
One correction. The line, as stated to me, was not a political payoff to Jeff Cook. It was simply that it was a political payoff, and we understood through other avenues that Jeff Cook was involved.
All right. I think that's a fair correction. Do you know whether Commissioner Rudd was asked about that alleged statement before the grand jury?
I don't believe she was before the grand jury.
But Mr. Hickey was certainly familiar with the allegation, since it had been discussed with him in your presence.
Yes, he was, and it was indicated to me prior to my grand jury appearance that they had made a determination that that statement was unconfirmed and could have been highly prejudicial, and for that reason, to not bring it to the attention of the grand jury.
All right. You say that in due course, you and Ron Lawrence and went to Lori Herman to discuss this request for files.
That's correct.
Did you expect that she would inform the governor to the extent that she thought it was appropriate?
Yes, I did.
Did you or Mr. Lawrence suggest that she should show the governor the files that you were delivering to her?
I don't think we reduced it to that specificity. We understood that she would show it to the governor.
Would show it to the governor?
Either show the file or relay the substance as she thought appropriate.
As she thought appropriate.
That's correct.
You and Mr. Lawrence and left what she would do with this information in her discretion. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, let's get to what was in there. You've characterized it at counsel's invitation, consistently with what other people have testified to, as containing embarrassing material. First of all, let me ask what it was specifically that you regarded in there as embarrassing.
Again, embarrassing to me is in the context of a press article, and the embarrassing aspect of that material indicated some concern from lower-level Department of Administration officials of improper intervention through the governor's office in a procurement.
Through the governor's office?
And specific reference in those notes to Mr. Shively.
Was there any reference of which you were aware to improper action by the governor personally?
Not at all.
So the embarrassing part of it was the set of allegations by these people at the operating level that there'd been improper intervention by John Shively.
Correct, and the only information we had available to us at that time was the Jeff Cook connection to Mr. Shively.
All right. Now, you say that, let me go back half a step, in connection with the visit to Lori Herman, you first had a meeting with the chief prosecutor, Dan Hickey, you and Mr. Lawrenson.
That's correct.
And it was agreed, or it was the consensus of that meeting, that you and Mr. Lawrenson would go downstairs, one floor down, and inform the governor's executive assistant of this inquiry from the press and of the potentially embarrassing nature of the material.
That's correct.
And so it was assumed that she would or could report this to the governor.
That's correct.
But no one saw any reason why the governor himself shouldn't be warned about this, I take it.
We had no information available to us at the time to indicate any basis for concern of her sharing that information.
The governor was not the object of the accusation, so it was, in your judgment, quite appropriate to let him know that others might be the object of the accusations. Is that correct?
That's correct. And again, we had made the legal determination that there was no basis not to release the file at that time because it was included in Mr. Jones's request for information.
Let's turn now, Mr. Rubini, to what counsel has marked as Exhibit S3. I take it that what you've identified as the package of papers and as has been explained, did not consist of the conveniently retyped legal size pages that are attached to the standard letter size pages that are Exhibit S3. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So when you handed some papers to Lori Herman, they looked like the legal size, the letter size pages that we have here as S3.
For these handwritten portions, yes.
Yes. Well, is there anything else that's different, as far as you can tell?
The file contained a great deal of other information. Those portions that I Xeroxed, I believe all were of this size.
Yes. These were what you or Anselm Stack had identified as the potentially embarrassing documents.
Anselm Steck had identified some. We had picked out others that were of concern to us.
But as of the time you delivered some papers to Lori Herman, this was what you thought she ought to be aware of, Exhibit S3.
That's correct.
And did the documents, as you delivered them to Ms. Herman, look substantially no more legible than S3 as it's now before the members of the Senate?
Even the originals were difficult to read. The Xeroxes were even more so.
And one, we might assume that that's the reason why Senate counsel was courteous enough to have them retyped so that we could read them.
That's correct.
Let's turn to a couple of these documents about which counsel has just asked you. In the midst of the pile is the memorandum from Mr. Peterson dated the 12th of December. Excuse me, the 19th of December, 1984. This was one of the embarrassing documents. I ask you to turn to the second page of this memo to the file. It's kind of a self-conscious document, isn't it, a memo to the file?
Yes, it is.
You make that when you want to pull it out at some later point. That
there could be a variety of reasons for making
them. Okay. Well, let's look at the last paragraph. And in this memo for the record, not even for the file, for the record, as far as we can tell, not sent to anyone at that time, he says in this cry from the heart, quote, "Perhaps the interference that started on October 2, 1984 will relent, and we can still reach an agreement based on professional knowledge beneficial to the state rather than a selected group," close quote. Do you know if Mr. Peterson has ever been elected to public office?
I didn't know Mr. Peterson at this time.
Would you, as a person who's been in government for some years and has dealt with people at all levels of government, say that this could fairly be interpreted as the frustrated expression of somebody who thinks he knows better than the policy setters?
It has a paranoid flavor to it.
I think counsel for the governor is asking this witness to give opinions of which I don't believe he's in a position to give.
We're going to be getting to the what Mr. Rubini's understanding is of the motive, so I'll withdraw the question. Let's turn to the next document that counsel for the Senate has asked you about, Mr. Rubini. That's the January 8, 1985 memorandum. I apologize for that. He asked you about the January 3rd memorandum from Barry Jackson to Robert Link, in which, as counsel had you describe, Mr. Jackson lays out what he thought was the scenario of the pressure. But let's look to see what his supervisor, Mr. Link, said in response to that, and that's the January 8, 1985 letter. It's in S3.
It's actually come before the other. It's after the
yes,
January.
These are not in the chronological order.
It's the order in which we received them, Mr. Lacavera.
Would you mind reading that one, the first paragraph, to the committee, please?
It states, "You ask in the reference memoranda if the negotiations were to be serious or not. I can only reply that I expect the negotiations to be serious. I have been given no direction, and I have given no direction to indicate that the results of the negotiations are predetermined. I expect you and your staff to negotiate the best deal you can and make recommendations based on economic circumstances. We receive directions to try to locate in the Fairbanks CBD in a timely fashion. We must work within those constraints."
Thank you. Would you say that this letter is a response to Mr. Jackson, in which his supervisor tells him that his fears are unfounded and that he's supposed to negotiate a hard lease?
Yes, I would.
Thank you. Let's get a little bit deeper into Mr. Jackson's accusations. You're familiar with Mr. Jackson, I take it, are you not?
I've dealt with Mr. Jackson on a number of matters.
Are you aware of any tension between Anselm Steck, his superior in the Department of Administration, and Barry Jackson?
I was aware of tension between the two.
Were you aware whether Mr. Jackson believed that his job was in jeopardy?
I was aware that Mr. Jackson was concerned about his job. I don't know at what point in time that fits in.
Do you know whether that concern had anything to do particularly with the Fairbanks project?
I know that there was difficulty at the staff level on the Fairbanks project. I suspect that their differences went beyond the Fairbanks matter.
Let me ask you, Mr. Rubini, when you read these notes of Mr. Jackson's that are now contained in Exhibit S3, was it your impression that they were designed to build a case against Mr. Stack in case Mr. Stock tried to fire him?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that I don't believe this witness can answer that question unless there's some foundation. I think that he's asking questions the witness hasn't testified any basis to answer.
Let's ask the witness whether he has a basis to answer the question, Mr. Chairman. The Senate counsel has placed on the record what are said to be embarrassing materials from Mr. Jackson. I think the witness through whom these materials are offered can say whether, in his judgment, these accusations were planted for reasons unrelated to any impropriety.
Are they from Mr. Jackson or Mr. Peterson?
I have them from Mr. Peterson.
No, it's a January 3rd, Senator Fakes.
Why don't we have the witness give it a try?
As to the foundation, Mr. Chairman, or as to the substance of the question?
Do you feel that you could answer that question?
I have limited basis to answer the question, but I'm certainly no expert in improper discharge matters.
What was your impression was the purpose of Mr. Jackson's writing this memorandum?
I don't have any recollection as to what I thought at the time when we were sitting in Mr. Lawrence's office on Friday, March 29th. I have formed the opinion that at some point in time, and that one of the purposes could have been Mr. Jackson's job security. It also could have reflected Mr. Jackson's interest and concern in preserving a record as to what he thought was a difficult and problematic procurement.
All right, I want to go back to the discussion just for a moment that you had with Lori Herman while you were up in Anchorage after the March 29 meeting. You said she told you that she discussed it with the governor. Can you recall any more precisely what it was she said she discussed?
No, I can't. Our phone calls didn't deal specifically with this matter. I was at the time conducting the state's trial in the reapportionment case and reporting to Lori Herman on a daily basis regarding that trial, and I was also dealing with the litigation involving the Anchorage office complex in Anchorage, which was also at issue at that time, and I was dealing with Lori Herman on that matter as well. This came up as a collateral matter just in casual conversation during those phone calls.
Wasn't high on your agenda as an important item in comparison with your other duties?
I wouldn't say that. I was also at the time working not with Lori Herman but with Ron Lawrenson on a daily basis dealing with this matter as well. It was high on my agenda.
But to the extent it was important, you nevertheless don't recall precisely what she said.
That's correct.
Did you at that time, that is March or April 1985, have any information that there had been pressure directly from Governor Sheffield on this procurement?
No, I didn't.
And just one more question about this accusation of pressure, which was the embarrassing material that you wanted Ms. Herman at least to be aware of. I'd like to ask as my final question whether you agreed at the time you were making this report to the governor's office through Ms. Herman, whether you agreed with Mr. Baldwin's assessment of these accusations of improper pressure. And I would refer you and the members of the committee to page 18 of Mr. Baldwin's interview with the investigators, asked again about the allegations of pressure, particularly the requests that Mr. Shively made through Mr. Baldwin to get the negotiation process going. page 18, I quote, "From my viewpoint, what we had was, you know, a negotiation underway, and these guys didn't want to do it, and so they were dragging their feet, you know. Then all of a sudden, a constituent calls up and says, hey, why in hell can't we get our lease, you know, negotiated here? And so the governor's office then calls up the people who can get it done, and you know, it's perfectly natural. That happens all the time. I mean, it's weird, but it happens. I've seen it. Happens a lot of times. And I think that's probably a legitimate role for the governor's office to play and the bureaucracy. I mean, that sort of thing happens a lot," end quote. Is that your assessment of the pressure that was applied here, Mr. Rubini?
Mr. Lacovere, until we were advised of Mr. Arsenault's ownership interest in the facility, I would agree with that assessment based on everything that had been disclosed to us. Once we were advised of Mr. Arsenault's interest in the building, that cast in different light to the statement that there had been political pressure applied. Because at the time, things didn't add up when the only name we had was Jeff Cook working through John Shively.
And the matter was then referred to the grand jury, is that what you're saying? By you or Mr. Hickey?
No, sir. At that time, we learned that information when we met with Lori Herman on Friday, March 29th. On Saturday, myself and Ron Lawrence had met with the Attorney General in the morning. I understand that Mr. Lawrence and Mr. Hickey met with the Attorney General after I had left to go to Anchorage, and the decision was made at that time to initiate a criminal investigation. And that, again, precedes the grand jury. That was a decision that came much, much later in the process.
All right, thank you. That's all. Those are all the questions I had, Mr. Rubini.
Mr. Lacovere, the Rules Committee will take a 15-minute recess at this point. When we return, Senator Fakes will commence questioning. 15.